what are some of your glorious radio imaging production moments in the past? You know, what have you done that really stands out?
That's a very good question. I think most of it has been when I've written music. I've written music that's ended up on Z100. I've written music that's ended up on Radio 1, BBC Radio 1, the national station. Those are my big achievements. Writing music that isn't necessarily specifically for them, but when I hear, hey, guess what? Dave Fox liked that. He's used it.
Yeah.
Hey, guess what? The production guys at Radio 1 liked it. They're using it. Those have been really, really big achievements for me. Also, as well, when I started working with TM Studios, which was the next step, actually, after I started, like I said, when I was unemployed and I started making tracks, I sent my demos out. I just got them out. And the guys at TM, at the time it was Chris Stevens, heard my stuff, liked it. And I started writing pretty much straight away for TM.
So that's pretty much when you started working with TM.
Yeah.
So that's generally how I had heard of you. You know, you were the guy that was contributing all these great tracks to some of these services they have here.
Yeah.
And I'm imagining that Chris, he's known to some people as Chris UK Stevens or just UK or Chris UK. Anyway, when I met him a long time ago, he brought up your name for the first time.
Yeah.
So then your name kept flying around here, around this market, around America, as some of your music production. But basically, it was because you were unemployed and you threw yourself in your studio, took your musical background, learned how to put together tracks. But you put a lot of effort into the quality of your tracks. And now, we'll probably dance around some topics now, so stay with me. But
it's all good.
On the tech side of things, you know your way around a DAW as well as anyone. And Pro Tools, you know. But you told me recently that, you know, I asked you, I don't know what we were doing in here. I was wanting you to show me a different way to use compression on a bass drum. And I said, well, which compressor emulates, I forget what, some piece of outboard gear? And you said, oh, nothing. My stuff now, I'm going all back to outboard gear. So is that the way that we're kind of headed? Have we gone through our digital world? Are we done with digital? Is everybody who's anybody going to start going back outside the box?
I get a better sound out of analog, and it's a luxury. It's definitely a luxury, and in most cases it's only 10% better. You know, you can do it in the box and it sounds incredible.
Let me cut you off real quick. You're making a song, whatever the song is, typically it's for a wide audience.
Yeah.
What percentage of that audience will have any idea that you did anything outside of a computer versus inside of a computer?
No one.
Right?
Maybe just the tech geeks, maybe.
Sure, sure.
Hear the analog hiss on the end, you never
know. Or perhaps if, it would have been really cool if I had remembered his name right there. The guy who engineered your Abbey Road sessions, which I'm going to get to in a little bit.
Yeah.
That guy might be able to tell.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
You, what's his name? Roger something?
Oh, Jonathan.
Jonathan.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was right there, Roger. Anyway, so the point is, if really nobody can tell, at least the audience, your consumer, why do it?
Because that's a very good question. And I don't actually have the answer to that other than I'm a perfectionist.
Right.
And I do believe if you can get something sounding better for your sake and for the sake of, hey, you never know. I tell you, with the people that I'm working for, I'm not, you talk about songs, but I'm talking about the guys that write songs, for example, they don't work for the audience, they work for the record labels.
Right.
And they can tell. And for me, it's, I don't work for the audience, I work for the guys in the production departments choosing the music. And if that extra 10% of TLC can be heard by one extra production guy, and he goes, that sounds fatter, that sounds wider, because I've put a bit more of love into it, because I've done a bit of EQ outside of the box, then it's been worth it, you know? It's made him decide between that library A and library B and chosen our track. So that's kind of why I decided to start buying outboard gear and playing around with it and discovering, yeah, you can get a better sound out of analog.
So is it your impression then, you know, like for me, I can do radio imaging just fine. I know how to produce my way around some radio imaging, but I've always been tinkering with trying to become a better music creator. I'm not really a musician, so I'm still trying to figure out the plugins inside the computer. I'll get new plugins and I'm trying to get more knowledge on that. But am I wasting my time? Do you think that eventually more and more people are going to think like you and we're going to actually go generally back outside the box?
I think there will be at some point in the future a 50-50 split.
50-50.
The way I'm working, and I'm reading a lot of the articles from the hot producers right now, the big one that springs to mind is Dr. Luke, is that they work 50-50 outside of the box and inside the box. There's reasons I work outside of the box as well, is because things like quantize. I can't quantize. And so it gets me out of that kind of crux of wanting to quantize everything.
Quantizing, again, there's going to be a lot of people listening that are, you know, radio imaging people that have nothing to do with music production, and there's going to be some voiceover artists listening too. But basically, when I play something with my MIDI controller, you know, my little piano in front of my, on my desk here, I play it into my MIDI track. Mm-hmm. So I have a little, a virtual instrument pulled up, play the piano, da na 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 na, and it turns out that I didn't play it quite on tempo.
Yeah.
Usually you can right click it, go to some sort of an action and quantize it. It'll snap all those notes you played properly onto the grid.
Yeah.
You can't do that outside the box, obviously, because it's real, it's live, it's in the air,
yeah.
And you like that.
I do like that. You'll find even the tightest musicians will never play perfectly on beat, and I like that, but I've got into just a habit
of... Tell me, why is that good? You're not the first person, obviously, that I've talked to that say this, but why is that good? Why is it good that it's not perfect?
Because we've got into a world where everything's tight, auto-tuned, bang on beat, and it's making music sound lifeless, not human. And so I'm a big fan now, and I've learned recently that even if my tracks have got a hand-played tambourine in it to get some looseness, it won't be perfectly on beat, but it'll add a little bit of looseness to the track, or a bass player playing and he's playing slightly off and I'll make him play slightly lazy. That just helps a track feel more human. And sometimes, again, you won't know why it sounds better, but if I played you it with a fake bass guitar that was perfectly quantized, yeah. And then the guy, I guarantee you, every single one of you, whether you're musical or not, would prefer the looser sounding one because it just sounds more real.
And the word for that is escaping me, but you know, I can't remember what the word is. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but that organic gives it life. And when we listen to music, we do want it to feel like it's alive.
Yeah.
And so you may actually do a track where, you know, you drop, some sort of a, you know, virtually, you may drop all your drums, some guitars, everything in the computer, but you'll add in just one or two extra things at least, mm-hmm, that are live.
Yep.
Just because you feel it's important to give it that organic.
Or I'll play something myself, instrument-wise, like a bass synth or something like that, that I then won't quantize just for the sake of something being slightly out, you know.
A lot of equipment geeks, you know, tech geeks, that like all the gearheads, whatever. Mm-hmm. You talk about running stuff through an Optimod.
Well, I've got an Optimod 8100A.
That's the old vintage
80s piece of kit, which I absolutely adore.
These are FM processors.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what they would, this is what the sound would actually go through before it would hit your car stereo.
Yeah.
Back in, that one's like the 80s
or
the
90s. Late 80s. Yeah. And the other one I've got is early 2000s and still used on a lot of radio stations. It's the Omnia 6 HD EXI.
So why run stuff outboard through that? That's what I was talking about a few minutes ago. That's what can't be replicated inside of Pro Tools with any plugin.
No.
Why is that, and what does it do?
You can get close. There are some pretty cool plugins. The Waves L316 is a pretty cool plugin.
That's one I like for mastering.
Just because it's got all of the different bands that you can play around with in a similar way to FM processing. But just to the different harmonics that a FM processor adds and the clever things it does to the low end and the top end specifically.
Yeah.
And the AGCs that it has on board and stuff.
What's AGC?
Auto gain control. It's making sure that it's always riding high for the part of the loudness war. So when a song's only hitting 5 on the PPM.
But that's the thing that takes away dynamic range, isn't that true?
Yes, so I would never master using an Omnia.
So you never you wouldn't play the entire track through it, but you like to play the synths and some of the middle sounds through it, right?
I would definitely. I was the reason I did it, and the reason I bought these pieces of kit was originally to do mastering for friends and set up a little business doing, you know, get that just broadcast sound.
Yeah.
But then I started reading articles. First one was in Sound on Sound, where a producer, a renowned producer, whose name escapes me, from the music world had said, I've just discovered on eBay this amazing FM processor that I've run my drums through, and it's given it this really crunchy, compressed sound that I can't get out of any other piece of outboard compression gear. And so I just, first of all, I bought the cheaper one, which was the 8100.
Yeah.
I bought that secondhand on eBay for like $1,000 or something. Played around with it, compressed some synths, compressed some, and it adds a lot of noise, but it also adds that harmonic that I really fell in love with. And then I thought, right, I really need that Omnia. I really want to see, because I like how stuff sounds on air with it. So I bought it and started running lead synths, bass lines, kick drums, snares, entire drum, you know, patterns through it. And it sounds incredible. It's a complete different sound, and I think it adds real warmth and fatness to bussing sounds.
Yeah. Hmm. What other kinds of outboard gear do you can't live without, that you can't believe you use as much as you do, but never knew you needed it?
Yeah.
You know.
I've got a Manly Passive Master EQ, which I fell in love with, first of all, because...
You run that as a mastering EQ?
Yes, I do, yeah. I do run certain things through it as well, because you can get really good sounds out of bass. You can also fix dull mixes with it. But it's just really good for adding top-end shine and low-end rumble. So that definitely is my go-to. So it, when I'm mastering, definitely goes out of the box and ends up being printed.
When you're doing this outboard, like I told you, I was going to bounce around a lot right now.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
When you're doing this kind of outboard mastering, or, you know, I understand when you just run a track through and you bring it back into Pro Tools, and you are you playing out of Pro Tools? You have a patch bay, correct?
Yes, I do.
And then you patch it right back into Pro Tools in a different in?
Yeah. So what I'll do is I'll send my, I've got my Master 1 going straight out of 1 and 2, but also going out of 3 and 4.
Okay.
3 and 4 then is the beginning of my chain. Okay. And that, I take that out, patch bay 3 and 4, just plug it into what I want to add. I'll plug it into my EQ. If I think the track needs EQ before it then goes to any compression, I'll then run it through. I've got an amazing compressor called an Avalon 747 SP, which is a class A vacuum tube valve compressor. It's pretty incredible. And there's also something else that I like on it as well, which is that it's got a 30 kilohertz EQ. The kind of thing which the human ear cannot hear.
I was just going to say, so that's for the dogs that are listening to
your stuff? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just to make the dogs happy. But what it does is it adds harmonics further down. You know, so you half it, you're getting harmonics at 15, half it again, 7.5. You're getting those EQs and those harmonics and the sweetness of it further down the chain. It sounds great. Just adds air and, you know.
So you come out 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. How do you get back in, and how do you record whatever, especially if you're mastering the entire track?
So it goes in. It goes into the compression, or the EQ, then the compression, and then I'll either do a bit of peak limiting. I've got distressors and 1176s, UA 1176s. So I'll either go into the distressors and do a bit of peak limiting, or I'll go straight back in. But then all I do is on the patch bay, just go straight back into 1 and 2, record inputs 1 and 2, straight back into Pro Tools. And that's how I do it.
And it's a simple, I mean, it's all clean the whole way.
Yep.
You know, you're not dirtying up the audio by putting too much in the audio chain.
No. And I work at quite medium to low level going out of Pro Tools and do all the gain boosting through the EQ.
Okay, well, that's important. So your output on your, based on the master track, is that when you take the level down?
Yeah, I bring the level down.
So you bring the level down pretty good on your master track. Then you boost stuff up throughout that chain.
Yeah.
By the time it comes back into Pro Tools, it's looking like a pretty fat track.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it can, you know, certainly with the compression and the peak limiting, it can add some analog hiss. But I think that through the track can sometimes add, you know, it certainly did good things for tracks in the 80s and 90s when people were running on tape. So I think sometimes it adds a bit of warmth, a bit of analog
sound.
So
the amount of analog hiss, that noise, that, again, one reason why people have stopped going out of the box. Mm. Because everything stays completely clean and noisified.
Yeah.
When you don't come out, but you contend there's nothing wrong with that, it's not enough to make people...
I'll be honest with you, I quite like a bit of distortion and a bit of hiss. Third harmonic distortion is something I actually try and actively create. A bit of top-end clipping never hurt anyone, really, so I'm, okay. You know, I'm a big fan of that.
We're gonna get to the kind of the final thing. I want to point out, though, I already talked you into this before we started. I want to... try something new with this episode. Since you're here, you have a very strong knowledge of, you know, how to make a digital audio workstation operate, how to line things up, and how to put things into your chain. I'm going to actually do some video with you. I'm going to put you on one, in Studio B here at the TM Studios facility, let you go to town, and just let people know that there'll be a video/tutorial of you setting up a track. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, let's
do it. I said, I haven't had my guest in the same room as me in quite a long time.
That's good.
And yeah, I'm just going to abuse your knowledge on everything.
Yeah, great.
So now let's get to kind of where you're at now, because this is a hell of a thing. On the site, basically, I'm doing this episode with you and delaying its release a little bit because you're about to release the latest album for your Beds and Beats. Mm-hmm. Bedsandbeats.com. Is it .co.uk as well?
It is, yeah, but it's .com.
.com's good enough? Yeah. Okay. Tell me a little bit about this project and why it's so awesome.
Well, it's the reason it's awesome is because simply this. It was recorded at Abbey Road. The idea of the album is strings and beats. Simple as, you know, it was literally the track started off as just break beats, bass lines, synths, and every single track needed something. And I was thinking, what could that something be? We could go movie-esque with it and put on horns and trumpets, or we could go kind of classic with it and bring in strings and still make it kind of filmic and movie, but bring in the strings. And then in the past when I've done strings, I've done quite small sections with 4, 6, 8 players in the studio, just close mic'd, and we've dealt with that later, maybe triple track them or whatever to make it sound like a bigger group. But this time we kind of decided straight out we should be doing a big 25-piece string section with the basses, the cellos, the violins, the violas, and do it as a big section, or bigger section. Kind of the same sort of budget mm-hmm. that movie players would have for string players. Mm-hmm. And then we thought, right, okay, where are we going to record this? Well, there's really only one place you're going to record.
And
a
you're
movie
not sound. Exaggerating. There's literally, especially in the UK, right?
There's maybe two or three places.
Two or three choices.
Two or three, yeah. But the one that gets chosen so much right. because it's the biggest room in the world, actually, and because of its heritage. Lots of things for people in Britain, a lot of people won't realise this, but Sir Edward Elgar wrote Pomp and Circumstance in Abbey Road, so Land of Hope and Glory. I don't know if you know that song.
I do.
Land of Hope and Glory.
It's the graduation-y song in America.
Okay, right.
Pomp and Circumstance.
Yeah, well, Sir Edward Elgar wrote that in Abbey Road. So that's kind of, if you turn up at Abbey Road, Westminster Council and London, the heritage logo that's on Abbey Road doesn't say the Beatles performed here, it says Sir Edward Elgar performed here.
Is that right?
So that's the first bit of heritage that Abbey Road has that makes you go, wow, that's pretty amazing. Then comes Sir George Martin, who is the engineer of Abbey Road.
Absolutely.
And he engineered so many big names in the 60s, but the one that immediately makes you go, wow, is the Beatles.
Right.
It wasn't the Beatles' choice to be at Abbey Road. They're recording artists. They don't care where they record. It was Sir George Martin, the producer, and they invented so many things that you and I today would take for granted. Multitrack, invented at Abbey Road. Stereo, invented at Abbey Road.
Yeah, I did know about that.
And even crazy things like flange. Flange, I'm sure you've all used flange, Metaflanger by Waves or whatever.
Of course.
Well, John Lennon coined the phrase, it sounds a bit flangey.
Is that right?
And it was a mistake. It was phasing gone wrong, and they realised that they could recreate that phasing gone wrong. And John Lennon said, "Oh, it sounds a bit flangey." Oh, and that's where the phrase came from. And Abbey Road just kept innovating the way that they did multi-tracking by using lots of tape heads, various, and how they'd sync reels at the same time. So I just wanted to be in the same room and record in Abbey Road because it's just an amazing place to be in.
So that's exciting. So this is actually your second time in Abbey Road,
yes,
is that true?
Is. Yeah, second.
And time. This time it's all you.
Yeah. Yeah, all me
so,
this time. Yeah.
So this time it's just all you.
Yeah.
What are some of the things you have to deal with this 25, 30 plus people involved in the track at one time? What are some of the things that are going through your head and that you have to control?
Tuning and registers of each of the players. You know, can they hit that note? You know,
how do you mic them, by the way? I've seen the video. I just can't remember. How are you miking all of them at the same time?
Well, the great thing is about Abbey Road is, as part of what you pay for, is that you get the best technicians in the world. You get not only do you get the best engineers in the world that are actually doing the mix and doing the recording, but you get those guys that are on the floor literally putting up the mics, are miking the films. And so you literally say, I want a movie sound. And they will even tell you where to position the first section of violins versus the second set. So, for example, if you wanted classical, they'd be in a kind of a fan formation from left to centre.
Okay.
If you want a width, a wide sound, a width of a sound, you'd have violin ones to the left, violin twos to the right.
Okay.
And the cellos and the double basses kind of in the centre and fanning out from the centre. So those guys tell you exactly what you need to do to record. So it's an entire learning process.
Let me jump in with a dumb question.
Okay.
I fear it's going to be pretty dumb, but you're miking this room from various positions.
Yes.
And it's also the way you set them up. Are you recording in 5.1 surround?
No.
I mean, are you recording in stereo?
Stereo, yeah.
So you are recording in stereo. So basically you're recording the left and the right side of the room.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Now, no, but what it could be, I mean, you could consider the ambient mics to be 5.1 surround because we have three sets of ambient mics, you know, one directly in front of you.
All recording on their own tracks.
All recording on their own tracks. Okay. I mean, we're recording, although we've got 25 players, we've probably got 50 Pro Tools tracks going in at one time.
So, okay, so that's what I mean. So you got 50 different tracks recording at one time.
Because we've got close mics.
Okay.
And we won't individually mic each player, but we certainly will have small clusters of the players being mic'd.
Okay.
Then we will have, further afield, we'll have the cellos mic'd, the violin first section mic'd. Then we'll go even further back and get above the conductor's head what's called a decatree, which is a left, center, and right mic. And that's the one that gets most used.
In the final mix?
Yeah, okay. In any movies. But unless when you get staccato notes that sound like dum, 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 you then want to bring that down and ride it and bring up the close mics, because otherwise you'll get too much reverb and it won't sound as punchy and attacky. So there's a bit of riding that goes on. But mostly it's all about, you know, that sound. But then there's the ambient mics, which are literally, because the room has a perfect 2.5 second reverb hall, it sounds amazing. You just use the ambient mics on a mix. You never put your own reverbs on them. You never need reverbs because the reverbs exist.
But what if you don't want reverb?
Well, then you choose a different room.
Okay.
It's as simple as that. With Abbey Road, you get what you've got. And it's basically, Studio 2 is the smaller room. And you get a smaller reverb, like a second.
Yeah.
We went in Studio 1, which is where Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, all of the Star Wars movies were recorded, all of the soundtracks. And that's a 2.5 second. That's, if you're after the movie sound, you want it sound authentic, that's where you go. That's the reason we did it.
Why do you? I've heard you mention this a couple times since I've met you, but a perfect 2.5 second reverb.
Yeah.
Do you say perfect because that's what you like, or is that actually a piece of recording knowledge that I should have?
It's acoustician-wise, it's they've tuned it to be perfectly 2.5 seconds. They've added deadening where they've needed to add deadening.
Okay.
They've added you know, shiny surfaces where they've needed to.
Gotcha.
To create that perfect sound. And after lots of tests, that's what they've discovered is right.
But there are rooms where there's more and less.
Yeah.
And they've designed them that way.
Yeah.
But this room, you say perfect 2.5 because they've literally designed it to do exactly that, and mm-hmm. no less, no more, so you know exactly what you're getting in there.
It's the perfect hall for movies, and the sound that you achieve, especially when you start getting up to bigger things, like you talk about the Chris Moyles project.
Yeah.
That was a 60-piece orchestra. So whether you fill the room with 30 players, 25 players, or 60 players, or as in the case of the Star Wars soundtrack, our engineer also worked on the Star Wars soundtracks, and he talked about the biggest and most expensive thing they've ever done at Abbey Road was a 120-piece orchestra with 300 choir members in the same room at the same time. You get a perfect sound out of that room, regardless of, you know, I played the Steinway piano on my own in that room while people were setting up, and it sounds just as good as if there's 100 people in there. That's the point.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let me I'll put it if I can I post that picture of the microphones?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So there's a picture, you're holding two microphones. Do you have both pictures?
I do, yeah.
I just can't remember. Okay, so I can post them both?
You can, yeah.
Okay, good. So on the show notes page, there'll be two pictures. I'm going to write a note to myself to make sure. Tell me, illustrate what they're going to see when they see these two pictures.
Okay, kind of picture one. Story. Picture one is a photo of a classic Beatles shot of them and how they record. John and Paul on one mic, George and Ringo on the other, just recording their vocals. They might be playing guitars as well, but the drums may have been laid down. This is looking at their hair and their style. It's definitely a early to mid 60s photo shot. It's before the
it looked like third, fourth album at latest.
Yeah, it's definitely before the drugs and the crazy days.
Yes.
But it's still classic Beatles in terms of how they're recording. And as you can see, techno geeks will notice they're recording using Neumann/Telefunken U47s, U48s. And then, on the day of the recording session, we're now going to go to photo two. The day of the recording session for our album, for Beds and Beats, I bumped into the technical guy, who's been there for 40 plus years and has been through all of the heritage of, you know, he's mic'd for John and Paul, he's mic'd for Pink Floyd, you know, he's mic'd for all of those guys, and he was mic'ing for us that day, and it was pretty cool. And I said to him, have you got the Beatles mics? And he said, yeah, they're still in, you know, they're museum pieces, in my opinion, and they're still in use. Abbey Road is like a walking museum,
right?
You know,
yes,
away there's a battered old upright piano. You start playing it, and then someone will come up to you and say, oh, you're playing the Lady Madonna piano. You realise that was the piano that was used on Lady Madonna.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It's still there?
Still there.
How does it sound?
It sounds terrible, but in a good way. It wouldn't sound like Lady Madonna if it didn't have a bit of honky-tonk and detune about it.
Well, that's true.
So it's great, you know, it was really... So anyway, the mics, it turns out the Beatles mics were being used that day to mic the left and right of our decatree.
Yeah, and that's the guy in the second picture. Wait a minute, I don't have it in front of me right now, but is that you holding him? I can't remember.
No, that's the guy. That's
the guy holding him in the second picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you said you opened him up, or someone opened him up. They were made in Germany and, like, in bad Germany.
Yes.
They
were.
Swastikas in there?
Absolutely. The valves were used during the war by Germany for communication purposes. And they said, you know what? They're so expensive and so valuable that when they go. They can't replace them. That's just it. And they're still, you know, they're just maintaining them and the valves still work.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great story. That video, you've done a very good video to sort of promote this album and promote the session. I get the privilege of putting that on my site, not just yours. You have a new site coming, but hopefully it should be by the time this episode is posted. Your new site will have launched. People can go sample the Abbey Road music.
Yep.
I'm playing a little bit of it here in the episode as we come to a conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If that's cool with you.
Yeah, that's fine with me.
Well, great. Dave, let's see here. It's been about an hour.
Yeah.
And I feel like we talked for 10 minutes.
I love it.
I hope that's the way everybody else felt as well. We'll keep connected with you, especially for the UK listeners. Just knowing that your service, there's others like it, but maybe not as good. Your service is out there. If you work for a station and you have the proper licensing, you can go and use your music.
Yeah.
And just use and abuse it, man, right?
And in terms of how we're doing with America, get in touch, drop us a line, and we can do individual deals and things with radio stations.
And you can do deals with America.
Yeah,
I actually had that on my list. I didn't want to bring it up if it was going to be like, oh, no, don't talk about that. So American stations and or what if I'm an individual producer? That's probably not something that's feasible, right?
Not feasible right now.
Because of the budgeting, it just wouldn't be worth it.
Yeah, no, it wouldn't be worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If people, you know, what else? I know you're doing work with TM Studios, doing music cuts for us. Kissville, are you also doing K2 stuff?
Yes, yeah.
Kissville and K2, two of the big products here for CHR stations. Music for your writing, your composing.
Yep, composing.
I'm so glad you came in. It was a surprise that you were coming to visit.
Yeah.
I showed you what Dickie's Barbecue is like.
I love it.
And for those, this one I think is only a Texas thing, but today we went and had Freebird's burritos.
My first burrito ever. I loved it.
We get in, you know what, we needed to kind of do it quick because we've got work to do. He's here doing actual work as well. And I needed to come back and get this interview in. And I said, how about just a burrito? And he said, what's a burrito?
And I what said, can I say?
How is it possible not to know what a burrito is? But I guarantee there's a couple things you could say, you know, if we were in London, and I'd be like, what is that?
What about a Lancashire hot pot?
Yeah, no, I've never heard of that.
Brilliant. Well, when you come over, I'll make sure you have a Lancashire hot pot.
Oh, I'm definitely coming over. Well, I want to see, I've always wanted to see Sandy's studios.
Come and check us out.
But now that you're home, you know, now that you own Abbey Road.
I wish.
All right, Dave, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ryan.
We'll kind of lock out here and finish up with some of this great music that you did in the Abbey Road studios. Yeah. Dave Bethel, everybody.
Thank you.
Contacting you, is there one or a good way for people to reach out if they want to reach out to you?
They can either get in touch with me via Beds and Beats.
Good.
I check the emails every day, so that's probably the best way. I mean, I'm also on davebethel.com as well. I've got my own website, but Beds and Beats is the quickest way. Info at bedsandbeats.com. Just get in touch. Love to hear from you.
Yeah, do that. All right, Dave,
thanks so much. Thank you, Ryan.
All right. Thanks again to Dave Bethel. That was really cool having him actually live in person. He's back in the UK, of course, but bedsandbeats.com is where you can see the bulk of his current work, though he does have his hand in quite a few other things, as mentioned throughout the podcast. This is some more music from his latest release, Big String Beats. I believe that what I'm playing now is actually the final cut off that album, all the strings recorded at Abbey Road Studios. And again, don't forget to check out the video. There's actually a couple of them. He did a tutorial on making some, you know, fat bass lines for tracks. Video quality, pretty terrible. But that's because I'm not skilled and I used my phone to record it. But I think it came out all right. It's worth taking a peek at if you're into creating music production and you want to get a little more fatness into those bass lines. Also, some fancy pictures from Abbey Road, like I mentioned in the episode there, posted on the show notes. And, well, all the other audio, tons of audio from Dave posted there as well. A lot of good stuff. I will mention coming up, Matt Nikolic will be the next guest. Matt out of Melbourne Today Network, Australia. Yes, this is a worldwide podcast. I already have that interview in the can. I will wait, you know, a couple weeks, spread some time out and put that up. A great interview. And we get a lot more into technical stuff, you know, how to really squeeze the biggest life out of the plugins you use in your production and that kind of thing. Anyway, Michael Horn, another guy that I'm going to talk to in the future, really cool guy, great producer. We'll be talking to him. And then Mitch Todd, who is one of the big wig imaging creative guys, creative directors at Sirius XM. For music, in fact, all of their music station imaging. I'll be talking to him, learn more about him and his career and what he does and the entire operation over there at Sirius XM. And that'll be coming up in the future as well. Plenty of guests on the list. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can, as always. The Gmail account, if you want to use that, ryandreen@gmail.com, or just go to the website, ryanontheradio.com. There's a contact there in the top of the page. I have a redesigned website. Hopefully it's easier to use. I've had some pretty cool feedback on it. I'm very happy with it. I think it's really clean, functions well. It's fast. Things are a little easier to find. And another thing I want to mention in regards to the site, that I am trying to continuously add more and more content to the blog portion of that. So while the podcast will continue, like I've always done it with, you know, full featured interviews on you know, big time producers and voice talent. Also on the blog, I'm doing shorter interviews worked into there, tutorial videos as I've done in the past, a few of those, and just some more articles that may be of use to you. So I'll keep the blog updated a little more frequently with a wider range of content, and that's featured pretty prominently there on the main page of the website as well. So hopefully you check that out, subscribe to it, you get, I don't know, more out of that. And then the final thing I'll mention, which I'm very excited about, I did a post about this. It's a new product that I've been working on now for months. As I've mentioned now a couple times, I'm with TM Studios, building a country library. It's called 360 Country. I'm not going to dive a ton into it right now. You'll see a link on the website if you're interested in checking it out. There's a zip file you can get your hands on with tons of free stuff. Some sound design elements from the service, some custom music from the service. You'll hear the jingles we're making. It's pretty exciting, I'll be honest, because I get to have my hand in every aspect of it, and we're basically taking what you would normally get in two or three other packages, putting it into one package. Very music intensive, constantly updated. I'm pretty proud of it. I'm very excited to see it finally get out there, and we're just now starting to market it. And got some pretty good interest from some big stations. And hopefully if you are a part of a country station and you want to check it out, maybe get your hands on it, I would love to have you. It's 360.tmstudios.com. You can go there or just click the link on my website, 360 Country. Cool. Well, thanks again for checking this out. Another podcast coming soon. Otherwise, bye.